All right, tonight I'd like to pick up in the book of Genesis. It's been many years since we've gone through this particular book, but the book of Genesis obviously is one of the most controversial books in the Bible. No question about it, because it deals with creation. And right now, it seems like the overwhelming majority of people, you know, of mankind, and I don't care what country, what nation, I don't care where you go, it seems like evolution has become the most accepted. Well, it's a theory, but it's always presented as some kind of scientific fact. But there's no question about it that evolution is nothing more than a hypothesis, is nothing more than a theory. And evolution is constantly, in a sense, the theory of evolution is constantly evolving itself, because it seems like hardly a month goes by you don't read something in a paper that contradicts some other theory that they had based their evolutionary house of cards on. And I'll give you an example. There's 26 different evolutionary theories for the origin of our solar system alone. And the reason there's 26 different theories about it is because none of the theories really fit the data. The only thing that fits, you know, the data is creationism. And, you know, the thing that really is sad to me is that there's so many church members today, even believing Christians, who question the account of Genesis as far as the creation is concerned. They feel like, hey, you know, science has proven through radioactive dating, through carbon-14 dating, through all of these different dating processes, the Earth is 5 billion years old, and the fish came upon the sea 340 million years ago, and you know the list goes on and on and on and on and on and on as far as the millions of years that they toss around here, okay? And so they figured that, well, the Genesis account cannot possibly be a right account. But all I can say is this, okay? If the account in Genesis is nothing more than a fairy tale, it's nothing more than a story that's set forth so that we can get some kind of idea of how the universe began, but we don't have to take it literally. Well, I think it's really a ploy of the devil. I think it's really a clever ploy of the devil to be able to say, hey, if you cannot trust God in terms of how he has told us how he created the universe in regards to creationism, how are you going to trust him in regards to what he said about our redemption? I mean, you know, you've got to carry that kind of thinking to its ultimate logical conclusion. And I feel like there's so much scientific evidence to support creation today, but you don't hear it. You don't hear about it. But I believe that if you read this account, now granted, you know, these are broad strokes when we're reading this. God does not give us a lot of detail in terms of what he did and how he did it, okay? But he's given us enough that we just simply say, okay, we can look at it and just say, let's just take God's word at it. But I do believe, like I said, the scientific facts support creationism. Now, the book of Genesis was written by Moses, and the book of Genesis actually means beginning or origins, and it's the beginning of things. I mean, you could write volumes and volumes and volumes and volumes on these 31 verses, but let's just do the best that we can, okay? It says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Okay, in the beginning. Okay, he's talking about here God creating the heavens and the earth in terms of the physical universe. Because you remember when Paul, when he had one of his epistles, he talked about how he was caught up into the third heaven. Well, the third heaven is where God rules, God's throne room is. Okay, that's heaven, okay, in terms of where Jesus Christ dwells and the saints and the angels, right? Well, there's three heavens. There's our atmosphere, which is referred to as the expanse here as being heavens, and then where's the stars and the planets, the galaxies, and all that is the second heavens. Well, the third heavens where God's throne room is, okay? So when it says here that God created the heavens and the earth, he's talking about the physical universe, okay? That's when he created the heavens and the earth. It all came from the Word of God, all right? I mean, it's like people like, well, Carl Sagan, he's no longer an atheist because he's dead and he knows darn well there's a God at this point in his life or his existence, but okay, he used to say that the universe is the only eternal reality, that it always was and always is and always will be. Well, that's a bunch of baloney. Okay, we're told in Hebrews that God created okay, the things that are out of are seen out of things that are not seen. Okay, that's a very interesting statement when you consider the fact that the building blocks of the universe are atoms that we cannot see. Okay, God created the heavens and earth out of things that are not seen. He created things that are seen. All right, and it says here, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the water. Now, here's a very ambiguous statement. It says that, first of all, that the earth was formless and void, and that darkness covered the surface of the water. So you wonder, well, you know, if God created heavens and earth, how come it seems to be in such a chaotic state? And there's been supposition that, well, maybe the universe was created, and then because of Satan's fall, then it caused the universe or the world to become formless and void and chaotic and so on and so forth. I do not believe that is the case. I believe what the case is when God created the heavens and the earth, first of all, he created the raw materials, the atoms, the molecules, and the things that you know, in order to make the heavens and the earth. I mean, it makes perfect logical sense to me to say that, hey, if you're going to build a house, first of all, you got to need all the raw materials to do it. Then you build it, okay? So when you say that, if you've got all the lumber and all the bricks and all the concrete and all the steel and all the panels and everything else that you need to build a house, and it's all stacked up in nice, neat rows, you can't say, well, there's a house, okay? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's just the raw materials to build it, okay? Well, in a sense, God spoke into being all the raw materials that were necessary to build the heavens and the earth. And so when he says here that the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters, then God said, let there be light, and there was light. Okay, well, here's a very interesting thing. Okay, the earth is formless and void, but it is covered with water. And then God's Spirit is moving over the waters. In other words, he is now in the process of constructing, fashioning, shaping, molding the earth into, you know, a habitat for man. But look what he says here in verse 3. God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening, and there was morning for one day. Now, here's what the amazing thing to me about this whole situation is that this is the first day God created light. And he separated light from darkness. And he said there was evening and morning, and that was the first day. But it's not till the fourth day that we read down here that God creates the light bearers. Right. Okay? He creates the stars, and he creates the sun and the moon on the fourth day. So we got a situation here where scientists will say, hey, listen, the universe has got to be, you know, at least 4.5 to 5 billion years old. And the reason they say this, of course, is because they say, hey, listen, light travels at a speed of something like 186,282 miles per second, okay, something like that, right? And over a course of a year, it'll travel 5.9 trillion miles. In other words, in a course of a year, light will travel almost 6 trillion miles. Okay? That's a light year, 6 trillion miles. Well, when you consider the fact that, you know, you go out there far enough, you've got billions and billions and billions of light years out there. Okay? I mean, we're talking about immense, enormous, just a vast, vast universe. And so they say, well, how come this light can reach us when it's so far away? Okay? Their explanation of a universe being 4.5 to 5 billion years old is saying, hey, just look at the fact that we are seeing light from these distant stars that are trillions of miles away. But what's the first thing God said? Let there be light. Apparently what he did is, you know, because he himself is light, the Bible talks about light, he spoke physical light into the universe. Okay, everything was all of a sudden just all light. Then he separated that light from light into darkness. And it wasn't until the fourth day that he created the light bearers. So there's an explanation here, even though we're not given a lot of detail, that the first thing that came into being was light, not the light bearers. See, but the evolutionists will do just the opposite. They say, well, you know, the sun came into existence first, and then the light, you know, came. No, the light was there. Then the sun came later. Now, you know, God can do whatever he wants to do. But that, to me, is a logical explanation as to why we can see light from trillions of miles away, okay, and yet the earth be very, very young. Okay, so you look at this, and he says, and God saw that light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning on the one day. Okay? Look what he created on the one day. He created the light. Okay? And then in verse 6, he says, then God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let this separate from the waters from the waters. And God made the expanse and separated the waters which were below the expanse from the waters which were above the expanse. And it was so. And God called the expanse heaven, and there was evening and there was morning on the second day. So on the second day, what God did was separate the water, because there was water that covered the earth. That was the raw material that he was going to work with. Now, here you've got a situation where it says that God separated the expanse of the water. Now, okay, the way that the world was constructed originally is that it appears that there was a vapor canopy surrounding the earth, okay? Now, that's not too far-fetched. If you look at Venus, Venus has got a vapor canopy that surrounds that planet that's so dense we can't see through it. As a matter of fact, one of Saturn's moons, Titan, has a vapor canopy around it. It has a canopy around it that we can't see through it to either. Okay? The Earth had this vapor canopy around it where the sunlight could filter through this canopy, but it would act like a greenhouse effect. Okay? And we are told in Genesis 2 that there, before the flood, there was no rain. Okay? That rather mist would rise from the ground. So it was kind of a terrarium effect. And if you stop and think about it, the way that God constructed the world originally, if he had this vapor canopy around it, it would block out all the harmful sun rays in such a way, but at the same time, it would heat up the earth in a way that the moisture within the atmosphere would constantly be rising, okay, watering everything, and there would be a constant temperature throughout the world. There was no such things as barren deserts. There was no such things as polar ice caps. There was no such things as landmass that wasn't inhabitable. Okay? You had a situation here where the world was absolutely gorgeous. It was just ideal. It was like a greenhouse effect. Okay? Before the flood. And what this also did, okay, was that the construction of the world was such that it really added longevity in terms of human life, in terms of all life, as a matter of fact. Okay? It wasn't until after the flood that it's not just the genetic makeup that has deteriorated over the years as far as the gene pool, but it's also our environment that is very, very, let's say, inconducive or very, very, detrimental in terms of human longevity, where people used to live hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, okay, before the flood. I mean, now you may find people in the world that may live to be 120, maybe 140. I mean, but that's a rare, rare, rare exception, okay? It's interesting that back in a psalm written by Moses, and I believe it's Psalm 90 or 91, where Moses says that 70 years are given man, and because of strength, some may live to be 80. Okay? But then he goes on to say, but even the best of these years are often filled with emptiness and pain. Well, interesting thing that even in our most technologically advanced countries, okay, the average lifespan of a human being just hovers around 70, 80 years. Okay? Now, granted, you've got people that can live, you know, some people live much longer, but, the average lifespan is right in that ballpark. But the way the world was constructed originally, hey, it was really conducive to longevity in terms of a person's lifespan was concerned. So when he separated the waters, you know, like we see the clouds now, but what it was a vapor canopy that surrounded the earth. It wasn't that cloud situation. And then if you go and read the Noahian account of the flood, what it says is the windows of heavens opened up. So what happened was that the canopy collapsed. It collapsed on itself, and it just poured rain, and it said the fountains of the deep broke open, okay? And that's what ended up happening, was the canopy did collapse. And then what happened is that the earth, okay, became flooded and gutted to the point where we are told that the highest mountain was covered 22 cubits higher as far as the water was concerned. Okay, so you see a situation where the waters covered the earth and then God's Spirit moves upon the waters. He separates the waters in such a way that he makes a vapor canopy in the heavens and also the oceans underneath, and then a dry land appears. But then when all this water comes tumbling down, what happens to this water? Well, because now this canopy collapsed, the whole climate is changed. To now we're in a situation where around the equator, it gets extremely hot. But what happens at the poles? You know, it gets so cold that what happens is millions of cubic miles or tons of water have become frozen wastelands. Now we're living in a world that's totally changed. The geography and the topography and everything, the climate, everything is now changed. And it's not as conducive to longevity. It's not as conducive to life. There's deserts and there's lands that are uninhabitable. And there's all kinds of places on Earth that even though man can survive in, I mean, it's just not conducive to life the way that it was before the flood. We'll start with verse 7. And God made the expanse and separated the waters which were below the expanse and the waters which were above the expanse. And it was so, and God called the expanse heaven, and there was evening and there was morning. Okay, that was the second day. Then verse 9 says, then God said, let the waters below the heavens be gathered into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. Okay, now he said, the water be gathered into one place. Okay, he separated the waters, okay, in such a way that now the dry land appeared. Now here's another interesting thing. I think if you go back to, I think it's Genesis 11, where it talks about the earth being divided at that particular time. Well, we've all heard of the continental divides, okay, and how the world has got, there are seven continents of the world. Well, there's a very good chance that at one particular time, the world was just one massive landmass, okay? Because if you look at a globe, if you look at any globe, they will show you that it's almost like a puzzle that you can piece together as far as the land masses are concerned. Okay? Well, if this was the case, then there was just one big land mass at this particular time. But because of the flood and because of everything that was created through this incredible disaster, okay, that the whole, like I said, topography and geography of the world was changed in such a way that, yeah, there was a tremendous, you know, splitting apart of even the land masses. And it didn't take billions and billions of years. I mean, it was something that took place over a relatively short period of time because of just a catastrophic event. All right? And then it says, he called the dry land earth, and the gatherings of the water he called the seas, and God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth sprout vegetation and plants yielding seed and fruit and bearing fruit after their kind, and the seeds in them and on the earth. And it was so. Now, here's another interesting thing. Okay? Keep something in mind. The earth is now sprouting all this vegetation. But there's no sun. Mm-hmm. But there's plenty of light, isn't there? The vegetation and the plant life come into being on the third day. The light bearers don't come into being until the fourth day.
Interesting.
Okay? So then he says also that these fruit trees bearing after their kind. Now, you're going to read that time and time again as far as fruit trees bearing after their kind, animals bearing after their kind, and insects bearing after their kind. After their kind. Interesting thing. There was an article either in today's paper or yesterday's paper about the Africanized killer bees. Okay, now they're becoming a real threat here in America. But it actually was an experiment. I think it was in Argentina in the 50s, yeah, right? Around 1957, where they took a European honeybee and they took an African bee, and they cross-mated them. And what they produced was a different kind of bee. Okay? And what it is a honeybee, but it's extremely aggressive. And now it's becoming a real pestilence, a real plague upon mankind. See, this is what happens when mankind starts tinkering around with God's creation. Right? God said everything's to reproduce after its kind. But here man, you know, tries to do this genetic engineering, and look what he come up with. He's now come up with this, you know, pestilence that he can't get rid of. And these things are now in a situation where they're killing dogs and they're killing animals and killing cattle and killing people, you know, and there's no stopping them at this point. This is one more plague that man's bringing. But this is one of the reasons why God, you know, put everything after its kind. Because when man starts getting in, starts tinkering around with all his genetic engineering, you can rest assured he's going to make a mess out of what God has created. And it's going to come back and bite him in the rear end. You know, he says here in that verse 12, it says, "And the earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed after their kind, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it after them and after their kind. And God saw that it was good. And it was evening and it was morning on a third day." Now, as I said, that's a third day. Okay? We're talking about 6 days of creation here. All right? These are, he says, evening and morning on the first and second day. All right? We're not talking about billions of years here. Okay, now I realize that Peter says that a day of the Lord is 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is but a day. And he's talking in the context there of judgment, but what he's basically saying is, hey, time is irrelevant to God. Okay, it's certainly relevant to us, but God dwells in eternity. He's outside of time. Okay, so you can't use that and say, well, because 1,000 years is but a day to God, and a day is but 1,000 years, then it was, you know, took 1,000 years, because even then you're way off. Because the evolutionists are saying that the cosmos is around 4.5 to 5 billion years old. Okay? Now, think about it for just a second. Okay? There's about roughly 1,000 pages in the Bible. Okay? If you took, you know, maybe a stack of Bibles up to your knee, you would have 6,000 pages. Okay? Well, if you were going to have 4.5 to 5 billion pages, those pages would go from the ground 14, 15, 16, 17 miles into the stratosphere. That's the difference between, you know, 6,000 and 5 billion. Okay? Now, either God said what he meant and meant what he said, okay, that it was six days, you know, it was 5 billion years. Why did he just say that? Well, it doesn't fit the data anyway. Mm-hmm. But again, I think the Christians really have to know what it is they're talking about, because they're going to try to be intimidated by the so-called sacred cow of evolution that nobody dares wants to question. And I say, hey, it is a bunch of bunk. Don't be so gullible. You know, have the intellectual honesty to investigate what's being said there and compare it with the facts, and you will see that, hey, you don't need to be threatened by them, because let me tell you, evolution is nothing more than a religion where it takes an enormous amount of faith. I mean, it takes an infinite more amount of faith to believe in it than it does to believe in God created these things. When you stop and take a good, hard, cold, honest look at the facts. For example, they speculate, scientific theory says, well, the reason we have oceans is because whenever there's a volcano, and they say that there's about 10, 12 volcanoes a year on the earth, maybe a little bit more, but they say that what happens when a volcano explodes is that it actually pushes out water from underneath the earth, and it's 1 cubic mile of water. So what they've speculated is that, okay, over the years, there's so many volcanoes have erupted that it's actually produced, you know, the oceans. Okay? Well, stop and think about it. There are 340 million cubic miles of water in the oceans and rivers. Now, if you're going to have one cubic mile a year added to the ocean through volcanic activity, well, what is it going to tell you? It's going to tell you that it's going to take 340 million years, okay, to produce our oceans. But the interesting thing is that back up 340 million years ago, there wouldn't have been any oceans, but that's when the evolutionists say that fish were beginning to come on the scene. You know, I mean, like I say, if you look at what they're saying, it's all a bunch of hogwash. And it all contradicts each other. You see what I'm saying? And none of it makes any sense. They say, what about the oil fields? They say, hey, here's the thing. They say that it would take millions and millions and millions of years to produce an oil field. But the truth is, if the earth is as old as what they claim to be, the oil fields would have been dissipated long ago. All you have to do is take into account the Noachian flood. First of all, you've got a world where there's no polar ice caps. There's an even temperature all around the globe. Okay, everything is completely plush and lush in terms of vegetation and organic material and everything like this. But then you've got this disaster where you've got this Noachian flood, where you've got millions and millions and millions of cubic miles, and I'm talking billions and billions of tons of pressure that's pushing down trees and leaves and grass and vegetation and animal life and plant life, and everything is being crushed and smashed together, and you've got mud thrown on top of it, mud and silt. It doesn't take long to make all these different stratospheres where you've got layers and layers of bones and, you know, and all these different stratospheres and fossils, does it? But it doesn't take that long to press all of this organic material into under such tremendous pressure, water pressure, that it can form oil fields and it can form coal fields in a relatively short period of time. I mean, you know, scientists have taken a ton of garbage and they produce a barrel of oil in 1 hour. By crushing it and smashing it all together. You know what I'm saying? The Noachian flood is the explanation for all that we see around us today. But again, you know, people just want to disregard God's word and make a mockery of it. But hey, for the Christian, hey, you can bank on it. God says what he means what he says. And he says here, verse 14, he says, "Then God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heaven to separate the day from the night, and let them bear signs for the seasons and for the days and the years, and let them be for lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on earth. And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. And he made the stars also on the fourth day, the sun, the moon, and the stars." Okay? But the light was already there. Okay, he just separated it. That's why we can see light that's trillions of miles away. It's because it was the first thing created, not the light bearers. All right? It wasn't until the fourth day that he created these things. And what did he create them for? Okay, not just to give us light by day and by night, but he also did it for what? He said for signs for the season and days of the years. Isn't it interesting? That's exactly how we get our calendar. We've got a lunar calendar and a solar calendar. Our solar calendar is based on the fact that our Earth goes around the sun 365 days. It takes 365 days for Earth to go around the sun, right? And then the lunar calendar is how many times the moon will go around the Earth in a given period of time. But it's interesting. It's through the stars and through the rotation of the Earth and its orbital path around the sun that we derive our calendars as well as our seasons. This was written by Moses 4,000 years. I mean, 4,000 years ago. I mean, this is it. Either through a lunar calendar, solar calendar, we are using the stars. We are using the planetary systems for what? The signs of the times, right? This was written thousands of years ago, and it's just plain as your nose in your face. That's what it's saying here. That's why God made it, right? Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is, it wasn't until the fourth day that he made the light bearers, but the light was already there, and the vegetation was there before the light bearers. And you can't have vegetation without light. Okay, verse 15, it says, and let them be lights for the expanse of the heavens and light on the earth. And it was so. In verse 16, it says, and God made the two great lights, the greater light to govern the day, the lesser to govern the night. He made the stars also. In verse 17, it says, God placed them in the expanse of the heavens and gave light on the earth. And to govern the day and the night and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. You know, and there was evening and there was morning on the fourth day. And that sums it up. That's the fourth day of creation. Then verse 20 says, and God said, let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures, and let the birds fly above the earth in the open expanse of the heavens. Now, here's an interesting thing. Okay, God, first of all, God said, let the oceans teem with living things. Okay, I mean, the ocean is just an absolute marvel. This is an absolute marvel when you look at the incredible. I mean, I look at some of these geographic films and these nature films, and I've been snorkeling before, and you know, it's just amazing what you see underwater. The life that's under there. I mean, I'm looking on the ocean floor and I'm seeing spiders walking around. I'm going, oh my gosh! I mean, it's amazing what you see. And it says, let the oceans teem with life, right? And it didn't all just evolve, and it came spontaneously, all of this different life. And then what happens? He says this. Look at this. He goes from ocean life to what? To birds. Look at what he says here. He says, verse 20, it says, God said, let the waters teem with the swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth in the open expanse of the heavens. So God created the fish first, then the birds, Okay? And he says, and God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, which with which the waters swarmed after their kind, every winged bird after its kind. And God saw that it was good, and God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters of the sea, and the birds multiply upon the earth. And there was evening and there was morning on the fifth day. So look at what he did. He made the fish first, and all everything that teems in the ocean, and then he made the birds the same day, and he made all, he says, the monsters in the water. In other words, hey, we're talking about here, you know, God had created the world in such a way that it was very, very conducive for very large animals. Mm-hmm. We're talking, not just talking about dinosaurs here, we're talking about big, huge sea monsters, okay? That these creatures could live in the water. Well, he created them on the fifth day. But here, what do the evolutionists say? Well, you know, you got your polywog comes out of the water and then he sprouts legs and then he kind of moves himself up to become, you know, some kind of animal, and the animal eventually becomes a bird. Well, no. He goes fish, birds. Then, the sixth day is the animals. You see? He says here in that verse 24, and God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth, and after their kind. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth and after their kind, and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps on the ground after its kind. And God saw that it was good. Okay, that's the sixth day that God creates what? He creates the cattle. He creates all the animals on the earth. He creates all the insects. All every creeping thing upon the earth is on the sixth day. Right? So you go fish first, bird second, animals and insects third. Okay, this flies in the face of all this evolutionary, you know, hocus pocus too. Okay, then he says here in that verse 26, then God said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness, and let him rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. And God created man in his own image, in the image of God he created him, male and female he created him. Now, here to me, you can't have it any clearer in that verse 26. Then God, singular, said, let us, plural, make man in our, plural, image, and according to our, plural, likeness, and let them rule over the fish and sea, etc. In other words, God is singular, but he's talking in the plural. If you will find throughout the scripture, you will find Jesus Christ being referred to as Lord and Creator and God. You will find God the Father referred to God, Creator, and Lord. You will find the Holy Spirit referred to as God, Creator, and Lord. Okay? The triune Godhead. It says, let us. Who's he talking to if he's not talking to himself? God, singular, said, let us make man in our image. He wasn't talking to no angels. He's talking to himself. Or, you know, let us make man in our image. Okay? But what he says here is, he says, we'll make man in our image. Now, what does it mean to be made in the image of God? Well, you know, I've often wondered, well, what's the big distinction between a man and an angel? Because, first of all, you can see the distinction between a man and a beast. Man has a God consciousness. Man has a self-consciousness. Man has a free will. Man has an intellect that can question his existence, okay? But also look at the way we are made up emotionally. Our emotional component is really quite unique in terms of our ability to feel hurt, to feel grieved, to feel joy, to feel sorrow, to feel laughter, to feel anger, to feel resentment, to feel loneliness, to feel... All of these different things are a reflection of what God is. What we are in a miniature sense, God is in an infinite sense. Okay, and I don't know exactly what separates us, you know, from angels, but there is a separation there in terms of I've never read anywhere where it says God created angels in his image and likeness. He created man in his image and likeness, and he created angels to be ministering spirits unto men. Okay, but angels were created a little higher than men, but they have a different nature that's actually different from God's. We are more like God in his nature than angels are. Okay? Believe it or not. Okay, but angels have a self-awareness. They have a consciousness. But there's something about the makeup of an angel that makes them distinct. Okay, they may not have the emotional component. For one thing, man is in a position where he can procreate. He can reproduce his kind. An angel, apparently, God spoke into existence all the angels at once. Angels do not have the ability to reproduce themselves. At least there's no suggestion of it whatsoever in Scripture. Okay? God could reproduce himself in the sense of making man in his image. And man has that capacity to reproduce himself. Okay? I mean, there's if you stop and think about it, there could be a lot of unique things about man that distinguishes him from angels. But yet angels are made higher than man, but it's just for a little while. That's what the Bible says. Okay? So then it says in verse 27, God created him, man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female he created. Now, this chapter 1 is just giving an overview of creation. When we get into chapter 2, God will give us the details of how he created women or the woman. But here he says very plainly that he created male and female in his image and likeness. And the fact that they are male and female, okay, there's a sexuality there. There's a distinction there. There's a definite difference between men and women, and it's not just anatomically. I mean, it's emotionally, it's biochemically. I mean, it's just incredible how men are different than women, okay, in so many, many ways. The differences that God created men and women were meant by God to complement one another, and they had a perfect complementary element for each other before the fall. But once they fell, then these areas of that were complementary to one another became areas of conflict. And so from there on out, there's been a battle of the sexes. I mean, there's been just the natural conflict between men and women. Okay? Because men think different than women. They perceive things different than women. They respond to things different than women, and vice versa. And there's so many, many differences. You could see that the sexuality that God created was for a very distinct purpose, yet at the same time, they were both created in his image and likeness, okay? I read an interesting thing. There was an article in the Chronicle today, and it was just talking about, I guess, an article that had been written previously that I had read. You know, there's been so much talk about the Titanic and, you know, it's sinking. Okay, well, if you've seen the movie or you read anything about it, you know that at that particular time, back in 1912, I mean, you know, when the boat was ready, the Titanic's ready to go down, the order of the day was women and children first. And the men recognized, hey, I'm going down, you know, because I have to give up my seat for a child or for a woman. And that was just accepted. Okay, now, interesting thought that's brought up today with the feminists, okay? It's like, okay, now we want to be equal. Okay, now who gets the seat? Right? But, you see, I bet you, you could have a whole ship full of feminists, and they're going to really change their tune if the ship's going down. I guarantee it. They're not going to say, well, I'm your equal, so I'm going down, and you can have my seat, or I'll flip you for it. You know, I don't know. You know what I'm saying? I don't think it's going to work that way, because there's a natural order of things, isn't there? There just is. You know, that there's a natural shame if you would think that a man would push women and children aside to save his own little hiney. Don't you think so? Yeah. Okay? And he couldn't come out and say, well, look at, we're all equal, you know, survival of the fittest. What the heck? Right? I mean, that's going to go over like a lead balloon, even with the feminists, I guarantee it. Okay? I throw that out because what I'm saying is here, there are such unique differences, and God created them that way for a very specific purpose. You know, and when he created woman, and we'll get into it next week, he created it from the side of man, okay? He didn't create her from his head, you know, to be dominated by him. He didn't create her from his feet to be stepped on, right? Right? He created it from her side, you know, to be his equal, okay? Just closing this down, it says here in that verse 28, it says, and God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful, and multiply, and fill the earth, and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on its surface of the earth, and every tree which was fruit yielding seed, and it will be good for you. and to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the sky, and to everything that, that moves on the earth which has life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. Now here's an interesting thing. Everything that God created, men, animals, birds, fish, they were all vegetarians. All vegetarians. I mean, I've heard people make the argument, well, you know, I don't understand. I can't believe in God because if God made, why did God make the world in such a way that, you know, animals eat animals and men eat animals and all this carnage going on? I say, hey, man, it wasn't like that to begin with. Right? He says here, he gives them every fruit-bearing plant and tree and vegetation for their sustenance. That's men, animals, birds, and fish. There was none of this devouring each other. This all came in view of the curse. But as a matter of fact, even after the curse, men did not start eating animals till when?
Till after God cursed Cain.
No. It was after the flood. Then God said to Noah, I will give you all these different animals to eat. Because then God knew that, okay, no longer did you have a world that was so plush with all this vegetation and organic matter. Now the whole world has been changed. The whole environment has been changed in such a drastic way that in order for creatures to survive, they had to start eating on one another. Okay? But it wasn't until after the flood that this happened. Before the flood, men were still vegetarians, and apparently animals were too.
It's interesting to note, in the new world, God's going to recreate.
Right.
He's going to go back to the original world.
Right.
And eating animals.
Right. It says that the wolf will lie down with the lamb, and the lion will eat straw like an ox. Okay? And it says that the serpent will eat the dust of the ground. I mean, it'll go back to that original divine order. Right? So in the last verse, 31, and God saw that all he had made, behold, it was very good, and there was evening and there was morning on the sixth day. Now, this is the sixth day. He says it's very good. Now, look at the whole situation with the evolutionists, okay? You got a world here that's not very good. You've got a survival of the fittest, and you've got animals devouring one another and destroying one another, and this whole thing of, you know, one mutation after another. I mean, It's just absurd when you look at the evolutionary account and the incredible mental leaps you have to make in order to put this all together. You know, that all of a sudden, you know, you go from this one-celled slimy amoeba, you know, until, you know, the hair of a gorilla that somehow comes into a human being. Oh, man, I mean, you talk about mental gymnastics. I mean, it's just phenomenal, isn't it? The kind of faith it takes to believe in this kind of nonsense, right? Anybody have anything you want to add or share?